After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nichtern, creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle. Facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/David.
So Julian, why don't you come up and then I want to talk about him a little bit and then with him a little bit, okay? Julian Lage. First, I want to say how we met, because it's kind of an interesting story. Yeah, and you feel okay to just jump in on any of this stuff, okay?
Anything.
Yeah. You want to say how we met?
You tell.
Okay, and you're
on a roll.
We'll do the he said, she said kind
of
thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So my oldest friend on planet Earth is Christopher Guest, and we were born 2 weeks apart, and my mom introduced his parents to each other. I don't know if I told you that. Yeah, so we've been friends a long time, and we played music a long time and worked on stuff together. And then about a year ago, I think it was, right? About a year ago, they came to New York to do a 35th anniversary of Spinal Tap at the Beacon Theater. And it was an unbelievably fun event, you know, because the movie looked like it was made yesterday. Yeah. Right? It was very fresh. Yeah. So Chris and I had been swapping. Chris met Julian first, and we swap YouTube thingies. You know, we were sort of on the prowl for young, bright. Honestly, we both are looking for the salvation of the human race through the next generation, because we think that it's in trouble. So we go, these are human beings. They're actually creative. They're actually wise. They're actually talented. There's hope, you know? So Julian was one of those, and I didn't know of you before that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is almost amazing when you think about it. But we met backstage, and with his, it's okay to say?
Yeah, of
course. Fiancée, Margaret, okay, just sitting right there, who's also a wonderful singer-songwriter herself, Margaret Glaspie. And we just started talking, and it's like he had the shine. You know, there's a certain thing that you call the shine. It's from The Shining, so it's from a sort of horror movie, but the shine itself was good. It was like, you know, kind of lustrous and luminous quality and intuitive. So we just drifted right away towards talking about meditation. And Margaret, too, you know, who they're like second, third generation from me in terms of the meditation tradition. But they were both raised. Your parents were kind of like
they're into it.
They're into it.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents are not into it. You know? And in fact, nobody even knew about it. So so then we started talking about meditation from time to time. Right?
Yeah.
And just let it happen organically.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. I asked you for a lesson. He said, we'll meet for coffee. We'll start there. And yeah, that was the beginning. Ever since we have a regular dialogue about things that I'm exploring or working on with a sitting practice. So that's what's been going on.
And how's that going?
It's changed a lot in my life. It's been all for the better. Every morning since you told me to do it, I do it no matter what. We can go into it, but it's been great.
Yeah.
It's been great.
Well, Julian practices. My students, I meet with them once a month usually, and then you can just kind of feel that person's been practicing or not. You know, there's quite a few students here tonight. And what's cool about tonight is there's some meditation students here, but who are also great friends and fabulous musicians. This place is stocked tonight with really CSM. We call them CSM people. They're creative, spiritual, and they're actually making a living with music. So I'd love to, one of the jokes we have going is we want to get the house band for the CSM. And we actually have one. That would be pretty dynamite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and we call it Band on the Sit. How's that? What do you think? So now I just want to say a couple things about Julian to set the stage, and then we're going to talk. There's a notion, Julian, in the Tibetan tradition. Are you familiar with what a tulku is? Do you know that idea?
I don't.
Okay, so you'll learn something new tonight. So this Buddhism went to Tibet in about the 8th century AD. Before that, it was cooking in India for about 1,000 years and had quite developed a powerful tradition. In fact, it transformed India.
Really?
Yeah, and there was a big university called Nalanda University that was, you know, all bona fide masters, teachers, and so forth. And then there was also a yogic tradition that people were out in the woods, you know, doing severe yoga practices and meditating and getting all kinds of experiences and realizations. So the scholarly tradition, the academic tradition, and the yogic tradition sort of came together in India. And then there were some, you know, really very powerfully accomplished masters. And in the 8th century, a famous one was invited to go to Tibet, and he went there. So in those days, the traditions passed down from a teacher to a student, right? But then this little strange thing happened, which was one teacher was recognized as a reincarnation of a previous teacher. Have you heard of that?
No.
So when you see that movie about the Dalai Lama, if any of you have seen that, Kundan, they show the Dalai Lama as a baby, and the monks are coming to him with his previous lifetime's malas and beads and jewels and things like that, and he recognizes them. So my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, was like that. He was recognized at 2 to be the 11th incarnation of his lineage. So this started a long time ago. And the name is tulku, which means it has a lot of meanings, but the meaning is a sort of a reincarnated adept, somebody who's a master who starts early and gets reincarnated. So here's my premise about Julian. I think Julian's a guitar tulku. That's what I want to say about him tonight. It's inexplicable from ordinary, you know, I've been around. You just don't find people like this. It's called a prodigy. It's prodigal. And so that's the first thing I wanted to ask you is, do you believe in reincarnation?
Sure.
You do?
Sure.
Do you think you were a guitar player in a previous life?
That never came to mind to me.
Because that would explain it to me.
Really?
Yeah, that would explain a few things. If you were, who would you think you would be an incarnation of?
Wow, that's such a good...
Maybe it's not a guitar player.
Right. I really don't know. It's funny because I've never seen myself kind of intergenerationally. You know, I see myself as a kind of a modern day nerd for this kind of thing, you know? So I figure anyone who reads enough history, learns enough about anything can be an advocate for all that came before. But so it's hard for me to say who that would be. You know, I've had many mentors in life, musically speaking. Probably the biggest direct guitar mentor is Jim Hall. was the great.
Did you meet him?
Yeah, I met him when I was very young. I was 11, and we. Jim Hall was kind of, if you're not familiar with Jim, it kind of goes as far as jazz guitar, Django Reinhardt. You get Wes Montgomery at a certain point, and then Jim Hall was kind of like the modern, cool, weird one.
Yeah,
And so I always looked to him as someone I wanted to.
And you studied follow. With him when you were 11 years old.
Well, I tried. He wouldn't teach me. I tried. But he would call me. I met him at a show. A friend of ours introduced us. Went with my parents, my guitar teacher, and his wife. And he was such a kind man. And we kind of hit it off. Met at the show, and then he would call me about twice a year, every year till I was. Maybe 20, and then I moved 21, moved to New York, or started coming to New York, and he would just call to make sure I was okay. It was very sweet. In retrospect, I'd answer the phone and say no, unknown number because his number was blocked. I'd be 13. I'd say hello, and he'd say, "What's the first chord of All the Things You Are?" I'd say, "Who is?" He's F minor. He said, "Yeah, that's right. It's Jim Hall." I passed. So he taught me in this way that Jim had a way of kind of making it feel like we all work for the same company. That was his. That's how it always felt. It wasn't master apprentice. It wasn't. It was just like we're all dealing with the same stuff, right? And that had a huge influence on me. We eventually moved to New York and we played together until he died. I was part of one of his last projects.
How old are you when you're playing duets with Jim Hall?
We were playing duets. I was probably 22. And then I was 24, 25. We had a quartet.
Right.
With Scott Colley and Joey Barron.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
I think when you don't have anything to compare it to, would be my guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably true. It seemed kind of, I wouldn't say it ever seemed normal, but it seemed harmonious. Felt like this doesn't feel bad. He seems good. I'm not taking advantage of him. He's not taking advantage of me. It's always a good start, in any teaching relationship.
Absolutely.
Well
said. So I had a few notes,
please,
from your bio on Wiki.
Oh, wow.
Which is funny. It's usually pretty right. You were the subject of a 1996 short documentary film.
Yeah.
Jules at 8.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, but I just saw this. Now I'm going to see it. You see it?
I don't know.
I bet it's on YouTube.
Part of it is.
Oh, part.
I have a link. I have somewhere. I'll send it to you.
You were 8 years old, and they're making a documentary about you.
Yeah, but context is everything. Keep this in mind. This was a grad student from Stanford University's film program.
Yeah.
And he was looking for a subject, He wanted a young person in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where I grew up. I grew up in Santa Rosa, California. And so he called. Somehow he got my number. He asked around. And I'm really close with my parents. I'm the youngest of five kids. So it's a close family. And we got a call. And he said, "I'm looking for the subject." And ostensibly they said, "Thanks, but no thanks," and kind of hung up.
Parents said that?
Yeah. I'd only been playing for a couple of years. What does he want with a kid, really? It's kind of weird if you think about it. Someone says, "I heard about your son. Can I film him?" It's weird. So we said...
You wouldn't do it now, that's now for sure.
Now everything... I feel bad for cats coming up today. You can't not be filmed. But this was rare, So we said no. We said, "But there's some other young musicians who are like teenagers you might consider, friends of mine, or just people we're aware of." He came back a week later, said, I looked at, "No, that's not the point. The point is about finding a young person who's a musician or has a propensity for something at a serious level, but also is basically a kid going to school and not yet absorbed into the infrastructure, without a career."
You weren't making a buck yet.
No, exactly. Far from it. And
25 cents if you did your homework, right?
yeah, chore stuff. But so somehow, I don't know how he broke through, but I think he helped us see that it was more about him than it was about me or my family, And if you see the film, it really says everything about him and nothing about me on a certain level. What's sweet about it, it's only, 20 minutes, 18 minutes, is, it's me going to class, me being awkward, me being... and guitar lessons. It's, you know, not much has changed. And so when I see it now, I go, I'm really glad this worked out, because I wouldn't have another, you know, I can see it objectively. It went on to have its own life, you know, and but it was his final in school, you know.
Okay.
That's it.
So, all right. And then you did study. You have at 12, you performed at the Grammys?
Yeah.
What did you do?
They were trying to, on the televised broadcast, they were trying to make a big deal that they were doing a lot for young people. So it's kind of funny, because they have a Grammy band. You know, they have kids that they teach all year, but none of them were good enough for the show, which I always thought that should have been their first, you know, they should have looked into that. They should have been poaching from the... So they brought in these other people who had nothing to do with the Grammys to kind of be the face of the Grammys for one night. And they had seen the documentary. That was what it was. So they said, we've got this. We assembled, you know, your colleagues from around the world, whatever. And we went up and we just played a blues. We played a Monk tune. And they put it on the show. And it was kind of beautiful, because that was its own whatever, you know, car wash of stimulus. But Gary Burton was there that night. Great vibraphone master, and he wrote me a letter after he saw me play. I played for, you know.
What's a letter for some of the young people?
It's like that, but analog. And he said, I saw you play. I played for 20 seconds. I wasn't on there long. I played a solo. He said, I there's something in you I liked. Would you play with me at TED, you know, TED conference?
Sure.
Back then, it wasn't as big as it is now. It was held in Monterey, and it was, you know, very small. It wasn't filmed. And he said, I need a, it was really funny. He kind of said, the theme is older generation, younger generation. And I'm looking for a younger generation. Will you be that for me? I said, sure. And we did the show. And anyway, that started a long, illustrious relationship with me and Gary. So the Grammy, that to me kind of what came and went. But what came from it was really quite cool.
And then you also... You were classically trained at San Francisco Conservatory of Music,
sure.
And then you went to Ali Akbar College of Music. I didn't know. Were you studying Indian music?
I was studying tabla and sitar.
Far out.
Very.
You get into that anymore?
No, I took one. No, I mean, I love the music.
Yeah.
Someone at the time said it takes like 120 years to master.
Yeah.
And so
one night to blow it completely, right?
Kind of. Yeah. I felt like I wasn't going to ever be that cat. So
yeah.
That's okay.
It's funny. It says, "Yeah."
I'm afraid. What does it say?
He has Jewish ancestry on his mother's side.
It says that on Wikipedia. They're not wrong. I'm Jewish. Israel Brownstein, my grandfather, great grandfather.
I'm sorry. That just really cracked me up.
That's great. I use it to get gigs, David.
Yeah.
Spices things up.
I thought you were going to say to get girls, but that's okay. So, one more thing. You have a series of albums out, but I want to, because this is creativity, spirituality, and making a buck, I want to give your album a pitch.
Oh, hey.
You have a brand new album.
Thanks.
Called?
Love Hurts.
So, the question I have for you is, does it?
Well, I'll tell you what. I wouldn't tell most people this. The simple fact is, is it Felicia or Felice? Felicia and Boodaloo Bryant were these country songwriters. They wrote a lot of these wonderful hits. So they wrote the song Love Hurts that the Everly Brothers played, and then I learned it from a Roy Orbison version and whatever. But I, growing up in California, we lost our house in that fire right around the time. You know, a couple years ago, there were these wildfires seeming to be an annual thing.
Your family house?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just down. Like, we were one of the first to go our house. My parents got out. Thank the Lord, but just barely. And
they were in the house when the fire hit?
Oh, yeah. They just noticed that the lights, the electricity was off. And they looked, smelled something, and there were these kind of like 70-foot walls of fire around our neighborhood. It was like doomsday.
70?
Yes. It was very historic and very traumatic and terrible. But they're fine. So it's, you know, knock on wood. So when we made the record, yeah, thank you. The concept of love to me was less romantic and more just whatever that experience is, you know, of loss or.
So love does hurt.
It can.
Yeah.
And that's why there's matches on the front that are burned, you know.
Well, there's a lyric to that song. You played it on guitar, right?
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't remember the lyrics to all of it.
So I want to give Love Hurts. Thanks. We don't have any copies tonight, and I told
Julie, I don't have any.
I think CDs are, you know.
The equivalent.
Kind of not really. They're hard to play. I don't even have a CD player anywhere in my life.
Yeah.
But you can go download it.
Sure. Yeah, right? Listen to it.
And you should listen to it.
Thank you, dude.
It's absolutely really cool. And one of the things you'll see about Julian is that he can play anything. I've rarely seen this kind of capacity, but he doesn't play everything all the time. And that record, it has some sparse elements to it, which is, we call it taste in the era that I grew up in. It's, you know, very, very tasty.
Thank you.
I want to just move into talking a little bit about some of these principles that we're going to be looking at this weekend. The book has a series of principles that are related to the different aspects of creating a vision for yourself. The cover, it has a mountain, and there's a little Tibetan monastery on the mountain. We're in a Tibetan center right now. And it has three people coming down from the monastery back out into the real world, or the regular world. And one's a guitar player, one's a monk, and one's a businesswoman. So when they first designed the cover, they had them going up to the monastery. I said, no. They're coming down. They're re-entering the action. Yeah. And that's the time we're in, as far as I'm concerned. This is, the world needs
absolutely
all the help that we can give it at this point. Mm-hmm. So whatever talents we have, whatever resources we have, and there's a lot of people, I think, you know, sort of aligning themselves with this kind of view. But it does come down to each one of us as an individual.
Yeah.
We're never going to be able to stamp that out of the process, you know. So I decided that my contribution was going to be helping people to polish themselves, you know, whatever it would take to progress their individual equation. Mm-hmm. Start with that, because if people are doing that and it's a healthy thing, we're going to have a healthier society. That's my personal view. Mm-hmm. So I borrowed from an Asian paradigm, which I studied intensively, which is... there's an idea called joining heaven and earth. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is something that is the principle for flower arranging, some government leadership principles. Martial arts has this principle in it. And it's the idea that heaven represents the kind of unobstructed quality of experience where anything's possible. So it has the quality of vastness and openness, like the sky. Right, and the earth is the tangible realm where there's all these little details like, do I have a battery in that tuner, and oops, that's the wrong battery.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's details that we have to deal with in order to manifest our relationship to heaven. So the role of leadership, of humanity, in fact, in this tradition is called joining heaven and earth, connecting. Heaven is the mind principle, earth is body. So we're synchronizing the mind and the body at every level, joining heaven and earth. So the first thing is to get a glimpse of heaven. And heaven, I mean, we should play that song. We could do a whole musical bit on this. So heaven is represents vision. You know, if you go on a vision quest, sometimes we get caught up in earth too much, right? Do you have a to-do list that's like a mile long? That's earth having... taken over and overgrown its usefulness to you. And you have no clarity about why you're doing any of it in the first place. So it just becomes a to-do list, earth. Heaven is like just, big sky mind, open, possible. Let's do this program with Julian. That was heaven. I'm in heaven right now, just
too.
So you know, me doing
too.
This. This is my version of heaven. And it came from no thought.
Yeah.
I didn't really have a lot of thoughts about this. It just kind of went, phew, see it. So joining heaven, clarifying heaven, that's why we meditate, is to get a clearer picture of heaven. That's really of what our possibilities are and what the open space is like. Then we got to ground that and bring it down. And that's a lot of practice. That's a lot of details. That's a lot of management, a lot of orchestration. So these two principles, connecting heaven and earth, you have a great idea and you make it happen.
Right.
That's called manifesting. While you're trying to do that, you're aspiring. Mm-hmm. before you're aspiring, you're just kind of wandering around, you know? Without aspiration, we don't know where we're going, why we're going there. So the first idea is clearing some space in the mental landscape and just, okay, there it is, there's my heaven. So I want to ask you what your heaven is.
Oh, wow.
First thought, best thought.
I was going to say here, you know, I'm such a student of music. I'm such a student of anything that I'm interested in. So to be in a space where I'm not, where it's not like a, you know, dance monkey kind of situation, I think is heaven. Anything where there's a capacity for things to be understood or nuances to be felt in a group of people, you know, that, or whether it be in a concert or on a record where something subtle isn't so subtle, and it's cause for discussion or thought or I mean that's the realm I am drawn to, right, as a student and as a, you know, professional musician, so to speak. That's it.
That's very it. Pure aspiration, if I could say so. You know, it's not corrupt.
I suppose. Now,
how's that going? How's the dancing monkey part of that going? Now you're coming down to earth and you say, I want to play, I want to be a student, I want to practice.
It's a great question. I've thought a lot about it, David, to be honest. I think so funny because, you know, as David said, I started when I was really young, but I was very protected from the exploitation machine, you know, due to my parents. So thankfully, I could kind of just, you know, I saw the downfalls. I saw where I could have had to be that person and do the thing and think I understand what someone else wants and use it as the basis for everything I do. But frankly, I was kind of oblivious to a lot of things. I didn't know what anyone wanted from me. The only thing I remember feeling as a young person was a strong, I don't like this just because I'm a kid. That's all I remember. Trust me, it needs to be good based on its own merits. That's the only thing I really remember. Everything else is a blur. Here I am as an adult, so to speak, and I'm more aggressively interested in having a voice in the community, whatever that means. Realizing that what I believe and what I stand for as a musician has to do with transcendence, with community. You know, the music I play comes from a tradition of improvisers, and at its highest level, it's not only nuanced and stimulating, but it's cathartic. It's kind of that, at least that's my experience to it. So when we talk about bringing it down to earth, a lot of the things I'm thinking about in the last year or 2 years have been, how do I mitigate the things that misrepresent the product? And, you know, there was a period in my life where I was kind of, I wouldn't say I was embarrassed, but I was shy about being a jazz musician, where I think, no, I'm cooler than that. I'm this guy who can play guitar and do whatever. And then there's a certain turning point where I just thought, to be part of a subculture of creative improvising musicians that connects to the African-American tradition and so many others is a deep, deep honor. And I bow to it. So I feel more like an advocate now than ever before. That's all.
Nice. You know, I want to just put a word in here because one of the CSM, creativity, spirituality, and making a buck ideas that we're putting together is pretty much centered around connecting people. So organically, this is kind of interesting how tonight happened. I mentioned Evan, who's designed the sound system and is operating the sound system. So here's how I met Evan. Michael Cameras over there, who's an incredibly talented musician and arranger and sax player and music director of some kind of really cool downtown stuff. You know, I went along just to go, well, he's my meditation student, I should show up. And then I just went like, oh shit. You know, this is happening. So that was a really nice moment. And then I asked Michael because he kind of knows everybody below 14th Street, right? He kind of know everybody. And I said, could we get a, who would you recommend to do the sound? For?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, Evan's a good hit. And I called Evan up. And in the meantime, Evan is part of a collective, a community in Brooklyn, right, called Apartment Sessions, NYC.com. And again, I just was checking it out and going like, what's this? And I was blown away by what they were doing. And what they were doing was so much in alignment with what you just said. That's why I'm mentioning it right now. Because they have a community of musicians. And the first video I saw was 70 young musicians in a park somewhere and then on a subway car. And it was perfectly recorded. And they were great arrangements and they were all playing their asses off.
Yeah.
And I just went like, what? This is impossible. And then I watched video after video. So that was another link. And so connecting you with them, because it sounds like your mission is so similar.
Yeah.
But that would be, my heaven would be that people with like-minded cultural leanings, you know, could come together and prosper.
Yeah.
See, for me, I prospered in the music industry.
Yeah.
And I never did anything I didn't want to do.
That's cool.
You know, but, and people should thrive. There's a chapter in the book called Surviving or Thriving. You know, we this weekend you'll see, we look at, are you surviving or are you moving towards the thrive zone? And the thrive zone can be whatever you want, because there's another chapter that says success versus contentment.
Right.
Success is the external rotation, right? What other people think. Contentment is an inner feeling. Yeah. And you don't need a lot of money, or you could have a lot of money.
Yeah.
But so where would you put yourself on that? What are you content?
Yes, but I'm anxious. I'm you know, nervous about everything. You know, not even in a grand altruistic.
My mother was Jewish.
Way.
It said, well, right there. It's
you're not wrong. It's in me. I'm it's funny. Yeah. If I pause even for a moment. You know, which tonight is an example of that. Like, I was recording all day, I was running, here I am, and it feels so good. And if I take that moment and I reflect, I'm doing great. I'm thriving. I'm happy. I'm content. But my day to day narrative is confused a lot of times. You know, all I can say is I'm worried, and it's not so much imposter syndrome, which I know is a feeling too of, this is going to end or people are going to find me out. It's just that you're looking at, this is all there is. There's nothing, you know. Yeah. There's no secret, but it's like, I think I'm worried that I would miss the chance to take advantage of this time in my life, living in the city with our community, you know, the community that we all share. It's like, it's good. But there's kind of a malaise that I think comes with, especially the millennial generation, at least from my perspective, where, is it community or is it a digital connection? What you guys do is so miraculous. And I was a fan of it way before because, you know, you can't phone in what you're doing. Everyone has to show up, learn the music, show their respect, be amazing. It's incredible.
They support each other at a human level. That's extraordinary.
Deeply. And that comes across. That's why it sounds so good, man.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, I worry. Yeah, so I fluctuate.
Well, so if you're me, or if you know me, and my son Ethan's here tonight, he knows me really well, and he knows this about me. If you don't want anybody to know something, don't tell me. Not the right person. Okay. But if you do want people to know about it, you should tell me.
Yeah.
And so this is when I discovered you and when I discovered Evan and Apartment Sessions, all my friends. That's the one good part of the internet. I'm just blabbing to everybody. You should check this out. You know, I work with Krishna Das, who's a, you know, sort of chanting meister, and I showed him the video of you playing a duet. There's quite a few of them online. He said, that guy's not human. You know, and he meant it in a good way.
Yeah, that's
you
cool.
know, it was a compliment. Yeah. Yeah, coming from him, that could be an insult, too. You know, the vision here for us, if we come back and work together on this weekend, is to begin to hone our individual journey so that we're maxing out. Mm. And this is, you know, a young student wrote me today and he said, I'm confused about Buddhism because it just seems like they just talk about egolessness and emptiness. Mm. And I said, that's not accurate. That's nihilism. That's not Buddhism. Mm. So the idea of finding your creative center and your life force and your expression and then tapping into the zeitgeist, right. That's why we're alive.
Right.
Now, if that happens to be that you're, like Ethan's a wonderful Buddhist teacher and writer. He's found his zeitgeist, yeah. His zone. But some people aren't clear right. What their offering is. You had, like, you're a guitar tulku. It would be really interesting. Like, what if I can't even imagine you not playing guitar.
Right, right.
It'd be freaky.
Well, you know, I hurt my hand years ago, maybe 6 years ago, something like that. My left hand, it shut down during a show, actually. I was playing a show. And ironically, it was a Django Reinhardt tribute concert, who famously played with two fingers. And I'm in the middle of this thing, and it stops. I'm like, well, that's okay. And then, but so there was a period where I, for the first time since I was very young, I was thinking, well, if I don't do this and I can't do this, what would I do? And the beauty of music and anything in the art realm is it doesn't take long to find another tributary to the greater thing we're talking about, you know? You know what's funny, David, too? From the outside, people, I think, it's safe to say the feedback I get is that people see it that way, that I'm here and I play guitar, but I haven't always been so assured. I haven't, and it's funny because I've noticed that with other musicians, Jim Hall was kind of like that. Every time it wasn't like he had a backup plan, but he always seemed as surprised as anybody that when he moves his hand, something happens, you know, and that you get to get better at it. And, you know, and I kind of feel similarly. I don't really, I don't share that same feeling that other people have expressed to me, right? I have a different framework for it, for whatever that's worth.
So here's an external perception.
Yeah, please.
Take it or leave it. That's That's the other Buddhist thing. It's
take it or leave it.
Yeah. That's the way it should be taught.
Yeah.
There's an expression. It's not direct. It's more from the Hindu tradition. Maybe some of you have heard it called the Bhav, BHAV. Bhav. And it's like the flow zone. You know,
yeah.
If you're in the Bhav, there's not a lot of thoughts going on. Maybe like in the zone for athletes, in the Bhav. And you can't get there by force. You know, you can't break into the Bhav cafe and go like, I'm here with my shit and I'm going to do something. So you are, from my perception, a Bhav musician.
Huh.
I see you enter the flow at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you stop playing, and the whole time,
you're
in a flow state.
That's so weird.
I don't see anything in your way.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a miracle. It's fantastic.
That's amazing.
So I want to ask you a little bit about meditation.
Sure.
I know it's sort of a newer avenue, but what do you make of it so far?
I love it.
Okay.
It's definitely the only time in the day where I feel, even after 5 or 10 minutes, that I can see a gap between the motor, you know, that's running, and some other interpretation of reality. It's the only time where I feel that, and that alone is refreshing. You know, it's refreshing. I haven't found the discipline of it to be tedious at all. It's definitely a reward. Even though I do it first thing, you know, it's kind of like, it's why I wake up. It's like, I want to get up, I want to do it, and then the rest I can handle. So it's that part surprises me, because I think I always perceived it as more of a, I don't know. I didn't. It's very friendly. But also, David, you're the person who introduced me to it in the first formalized way I'd ever introduced to it. So you have that way of making it seem like it's right here. You just pick it up, you know. So that's nice. And maybe I know I'm ignorant enough to be happy with it. You know, I'm not really chasing anything. I just go, wow, it's nice to sit here. You know, that's cool. You know, that's good. I have other friends who have long standing practices too, and I'm always very inspired by that. But it's but the returning part to it, just yeah. to what you're talking about, that's definitely what I'm charmed by. It's just the, you know, where am I going to go? How am I going to come back? Where am I going? How am I going to come back? That resonates with me.
Yeah. And then an idea we've been using a lot is the rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. Your mind wanders, but then it gets pulled down a rabbit hole, and you're in deep into some kind of like obsessive, you know, kind of compulsive area of your mental landscape. Right. And the idea of just like, you know, allowing the rabbit to go down the hole, but you bring your mind back. You don't follow the rabbit down the hole.
And story of my life, you know, when I grew up, I went to regular school for a while, and then the school, at some point, this is very Northern Californian in nature. They said, we don't have a music program, so we'll give you independent study and you can study with these teachers that I was starting to work with. And my parents said, no, he's going to be like the rest of the kids. He's going to go to school. Did that. They kind of insisted. So long story short, I spent a lot of time alone as a boy practicing 10 hours a day. This is and the rabbit hole.
Did you hear that, everybody? 10 hours a day. That's what these people, that's what Buddha did.
Yeah, well.
That's it. You play guitar 10 hours a day as a boy?
Yeah, it goes by, you know, your parents go to work, you do it.
Here's your answer, everybody.
Well, it didn't seem like much to me. It was never forced. But I was very much of the, I'm like a web maker in my head. Like I think distractions are an important part of education. So if I would work on one thing, I would be distracted by another musical thing and another. But if you do it over 10 hours, you get back to the first thing, you know? So I'd have these networks of information and history that I was trying to understand. The point is that served me well as a kid and less well as an adult. And we all know that, but Margaret and I joke about it where I'll get into these rabbit holes now all constantly. And I'll think it's not really, I'll think, well, it's not harming anyone. It's just my own interest, you know. Mm-hmm. And she'll say, is it? Like, is it really just in your world? Like, or is it affecting everything? Is it, you know, is it influencing the atmosphere? Mm-hmm. So it's been really fun to kind of not just think that any obsession that's related to something you're passionate about is healthy. Mm-hmm. Because it's not always. Sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. But that's been another kind of perk of it. I'm kind of calling into question some little kid stuff.
Well, it's all good journey and exploration. One of the really fun things for me right now is that, you know, Michael took the meditation teacher training program that we did last year. We're doing another one starting in May. Is your mother going to come in May? Okay. But he graduated and he got a certificate, and then he just started giving meditation classes to, and Jesse's been doing this too, to friends and family and other people that they work with. It's like just spreading in a very organic way.
Yeah.
And Alex, who's another great musician who's sitting right next to him, that's how you started to practice, right? Michael is your dealer.
That's great.
It's very cool. And if you have a question, you can just raise your hand right here in the front row. Here, could you tell us who you are?
My name is Hefe, and I'm not a musician, but a music lover. And I really enjoyed the stories that you were telling about discovering Julian's work through YouTube. And when I've brought friends to see you perform, I often share YouTube videos before going. And I actually have a question about one of them.
Oh, yeah, anything.
You performed with Santana as a very young man. Mm-hmm. And you got on stage and you did this Parliament song.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
And I just, as a young person, I wouldn't have encountered that song in the first place. And you talked about yourself studying classical and jazz. Yeah. And it seems... there's just has to be a story behind it, and I'm fascinated. I don't want to lead you. I want to let tell the story.
I appreciate that. I'll keep it short. I the song I didn't know. I mean, Parliament I knew as a young, you know. I don't know if it's one because it's related to guitar culture. Guitar culture leads to blues culture, to funk culture, and also it's, you know, the Bay Area, for God's sake. That's what's cool up there. It's a lot of that. My dad waited tables for many years when I was young, for like my mother for many years as well. That's how they met. They were in the restaurant industry. My father used to wait on a guy who knew Santana. It's so weird to think about this happening today. It probably wouldn't. At one point, my dad was talking to this guy. Said, I have a son who plays guitar. I said, oh, you have a son who plays guitar? I'm friends with Santana, blah, blah, blah. And he says, okay. Remember, it's pre-YouTube, so it wasn't like, oh, I'll have to go check your son out. He just asked, Mario has a son named Julian. Cool. And then he was a regular, so he came to the restaurant and said, you know, Santana's playing like in a month, opposite Jeff Beck. They're doing this double bill tour in Shoreline Amphitheater. You should come, bring Julian. And so we literally, it's just so old fashioned. My dad said, what time? He said, oh, they sound check around 5. So my mom and my dad and me drive up, just no security, walk in the back door and really just find the door that says Carlos Santana on it. We knock on it. We go in, who are, well, you know, what, I forget the guy's name now. It's funny. It told us to, oh yeah, yeah, where I was expecting you. Do you want to play a song with me? So Santana and I, I was 7 at this point. But it wasn't like merit based. You know what I mean? That's the beauty of it. It wasn't like, let's see how good you are. It's just, you're a kid. You can't, how harmful could you be? So we played and Carlos was very sweet. He said, oh, that's great. You should sit in with us tonight. And, it's like 20,000 people. My parents, we said no. So that night we said no. Because it's a lot to throw on a kid, you know. I really was just going to meet the guy and go home, you know. And so my parents being, you know, the hippest folks, they just said, thank you, but no thank you. And since I said, I get it. That would be a lot, you know. Yeah. Come back in a year. We'll be here. So without ever talking to him in the meantime, we just looked at the schedule, and sure enough, he played the same place a year later, drove up to the back door, and I had my guitar, and he said, you want to do it this time? I said, sure. And so he said, we'll do the song, and it's one chord, if I'm not mistaken. And so it's not, you know, rocket scientist, you know, size stuff. He was like, you'll be fine. And he said, you'll play here, then you'll stop. And that's all that happened. That's all that happened. And I walked off the stage. And then like a deck 15 years later, there was a video of it. But it was. I love that era. You were such a secret, you know. You could do these kind of fabulous things and no one saw it.
Is that video online now?
It's on YouTube.
Yeah. I sound good. I heard it. I sound bad. Because I couldn't do anything but like one thing. And I thought, oh, I've gotten worse. Wasn't that sweet?
And the look on his face, he was just like...
He's such a gentleman. Wow. No, he's a special cat. He's exactly what you think.
Anybody else? There's some folks here in the front row, and then we can just pass it back to you next, okay?
Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
Oh, can you say your name, too?
My name's Jacob. I'm studying music in college right now.
Cool.
And I'm a humongous fan of yours.
Cool.
Just wanted to ask, when you talk about the flow state in improvising, but how do you try to achieve that when composing, when you oftentimes have to take pauses
question.
And come back? Like, how do you find that spark in something you're working on and you are forced by everyday life to pause?
Oh my God. Do you write music?
I do.
How do you do it?
He's studying Buddhism.
There you go. This is a humongous struggle. I mean,
yeah, what happens? You get distracted and then you're like, oh, I can't really enter back into
exactly.
that place.
Exactly. The second you kind of have that question, like, how are people going to receive this? Is the first road or the first negative thought that enters and it just it goes downhill from there. So I'm wondering, how do you stay above
recover.
That fray, yeah, kind of.
Oh my God. Well, don't get me started, because I think about this constantly. Margaret and I talk about this constantly, and I know time is of the essence. So okay, but I'll try to be focused. A couple things. What, you know, the nature of the music that I write, you know, it's instrumental music, and so it's abstract. You could say that about really anything, even lyrical music, of course, but it's pointedly without a topic, you know what I mean? Unless you're writing something for a topic, like a dedication piece or whatever it may be. So
it's all instrumental?
It's all instrumental music.
Have you and Margaret ever written together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great. That was a good combination.
So that was a song with lyrics?
We have a whole book of music. It was a band we had for, we still have it, called Rude Ruth. Rude Ruth is, and it's just the two of us. And then, but it was before we dated. So it was many years ago. And then we became a couple, and it seemed less important to have the band. It was just an excuse to be together. But the music was
good. Would you
come
home with me tonight? You guys don't need to come.
Yeah, exactly. but it's a good connection, because Margaret writes lyrical music where it is so much about getting to the heart of what you're trying to say. You know, what's the sentiment? How do you get the excess out of it? So it's very strategic and very structural, as far as my perception of it.
Architectural?
Yeah, absolutely. And arrange. Here's the big thing. The difference with Margaret's, her thing involves arranging and composing at the same time. You know, the song's not a song unless there's an arrangement. So my field feels way more meandering. A couple things I would say is Mick Goodrick, the guitar teacher, and wrote
Berkeley, right?
Berkeley, yeah. He was a total guitar guru guy, and I used to study with him. And he once told
me he was teaching there when I went there in 1970. That's unbelievable.
He taught everybody. That's amazing.
Is he still there?
No, he just retired.
Ah, good.
He just retired.
Yeah. Hope he's well.
Exactly. Me too.
May he live in peace.
Yeah, I miss him. I asked him a similar question, and he said, "Oh yeah." He just had the answer. It wasn't like nuance. How do you do this? Oh yeah, I'll tell you. And it's what he said is, what you do is you buy a baseball hat. And I said, okay. And he said, well, what you do is every time you go to write, you put the hat on, and when you're done writing, you take the hat off. That's the whole thing. And what was so interesting, you know, to fast forward through a couple of steps, is that his point was, if you're coming from a performance background, the concept of having a discipline that you need a spotlight, you kind of do need to be on. You do need the audience there. You do need an 8 o'clock showtime to do something, if you're kind of wired that way. And that helped me a lot. I don't think I ever really got a hat, but I just kind of, I would set the time, or I would get the pencil that I wanted, and I would do it. And when I stopped, I really stopped. I didn't let it linger. That was one thing. The other thing is, when we talk about what people think, you know, I think that's one of the slippery slope, because it's such a projection. Like, I don't really know what anyone in this room thinks of anything. I can get cues, you know, that tell me, oh, that people usually do that when they're mad, or they do that with their face when they're happy. But I don't know. So one of the big things for me has been discrediting in some way that voice of people. When I say, would people like this, do I like it? Do I like it? And then the next step is, I don't like it. And then the next step is, cool, I actually am the one person who can do something about it. But it took me a while to see that last step was there, you know? I just kind of was in that mopey thing of, like, I don't like it, and I'm being distracted. So I always feel with writing, that it's important to remember, you have the best seat in the house. You've got the nuclear codes, you know? If you can... Don't say that. I know, but you have that power. You have that power to kill it. John Zorn always had a great thing. He said, if it doesn't sound good, stop writing it. And I thought, well, you're allowed? You don't have to, like, be a martyr?
There's a chapter in the book called Stop Polishing a Turd.
There you go. And that's it. That's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, if you're that easily distracted, maybe the music's fine. But you know, when you've been working on a project that's really, 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 really special, nothing can pull you away. Or if it does, you come right back. The last thing... Sorry, because I think it's important, is something Gerhard Richter, great artist in the world. I've heard him read things where he talks about the job of art being to kind of get rid of, find all the things the art isn't. So I write a lot of bad versions of songs. I write, and I mean that not facetiously, like, I'll say, what's the worst case scenario for the song? It becomes a rhythm changes, like, fluff piece. Okay, let me write that just so it's out. What's another bad? It would be bad if it was like a faux fiddle tune, but really needed a deeper sentiment. So I write a lot of scratch, you know, and then I just don't use those. And then I pick the one that's my favorite. And I don't know what anyone thinks of it, really. Bliss.
Yeah, you can't know what somebody else thinks unless you
Even
have a gift.
Even if they say things to you, I don't know.
Oh, they say stuff. They'll say things. You can know what they say.
Yeah.
So okay. Well, let's take one more, and then I don't want to.
He had his arm, I know, earlier on.
The guy right behind you.
Oh, him? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, who are you looking at?
But over on this side, I saw you. He's tucked away.
Okay. We'll do two more. Can we be succinct? And, sure. And then, because I don't want to deprive you of hearing Julian Platt.
My name's Michael. I'm another Bay Area transplant.
Hey.
And I wanted, actually, you mentioned John Zorn. I wanted to ask you briefly about that.
Sure.
Because, you know, you've done a lot of work with him. In fact, new album came out today with you and Gian Reilly and Bill Frisell.
That's out.
Just
wow.
came out. So, obviously, he's coming from a very deep Jewish tradition.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering how that spirituality, do you feel it when you're playing the music?
Oh, my God.
And how
yes.
has that affected your playing?
Well, it's a great question. Yeah, two things, and I'll keep it brief. John has a certain kind of charisma and authority that is so commanding and so inspiring, you know, like any great band leader. The fact that there's a connection to Jewish tradition, for me, always felt unspoken, but kind of a nice subtext. You know, I didn't grow up with Jewish traditional music, but I have to say playing, especially the Jewish inclined music, because he does, not all of it's Jewish, you know, in nature. Something just feels really, just makes sense. I don't know. There's certain attributes of him that remind me of my mother's side of the family. So it's personal, you know. I've been inspired to go that route too, but I just don't, I wasn't really raised Jewish in a strict way. So I'm kind of a tourist, you know, but it informs it. John started doing Jewish stuff to kind of appeal to the Jewish musicians he wanted to play with. Like, you know, so he, you feel it, you know, he makes it known and it is beautiful. And it has to do with the scales he uses, the feels he uses, but also a lot of the Jewish stuff is connected to like Motown stuff and funk stuff. It's really American music to me. And that's a whole nother topic.
Let's get the last question, yeah. And then we're going to shift. And here's the reason I haven't interspersed music, because once we get into the music, it's over.
Yeah.
You all know that. There's no talking. This is foreplay, and then that's the real thing. So, okay, last question. Thank you.
Hi, how are you doing?
What's your name, please?
My name is Omesh, and I'm here with my buddy Justin and his buddy Grant. And Justin and I are in a group called White Merlot.
And called what?
White Merlot.
White Merlot.
White Merlot.
Yeah, cool. A lot of backstory. But to be succinct, I just wanted to thank you so much for your service and creativity and the community, and we're big fans. And
thanks.
I wanted to note, this question could be twofold in a way,
possibly.
If that would be okay. The direction I've been going in my journey through performance and then looking at audiovisual and recording started leading me to teaching many years ago.
Cool.
And as an educator and as a private music instructor and having worked in the school system and private businesses, I'm looking at my passion for how young children are going about music and theory and art.
Right.
And I was wondering if you've had any experiences teaching or doing lessons or what it's been like for you and what age ranges and how it's been, because the music world is in a lot of different forms when it comes to teenagers and certain age ranges.
Right.
And I'm wondering what take you might have or advice on what I'm doing, because I'm also looking at mindfulness and awareness being put into it, but I can't just go off on all of that all the time because they don't get into it. They don't dig it.
Of course, of course.
And unless I'm like talking about Baby Yoda or something.
Are you coming this weekend?
What's that?
Are you coming this weekend?
I should be. I'm going to try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
it might be good.
I quit.
You're in the right place. David's the man for that. I hear you. I think I hear you. I started teaching very young, just by circumstance. I was a teenager teaching people older than me. I've taught kids, young children, and I'm not that good at it. It's just I kind of feel like we're both looking at each other going like, I don't know, you know. I'm like, you'll figure it out. And he's like, yeah, I know. And so it's kind of like that. So you know, my demographic is different. It's more advanced players who are kind of pining for something other than what they could get in a book, you know. Having said that, I think part of there was a phase where I taught a lot and I felt really responsible for the well-being of the student in a way that I don't anymore. I kind of feel like sometimes the best thing a student can experience is resistance and say, you know what, if this isn't quite it for me, you know. So I'm very conscientious not to be a student's best friend or be their buddy. It's, you know, it's not an equal power situation. It's not. I'm the teacher, they're the student. I need them to show up at a high level and I will too.
So listeners, a short postscript from me.
The interview presented here is also available in my Facebook page and includes the referenced music performances towards the end. Please feel free to check it out at facebook.com/DavidNichtern. The exact link should be in the text that accompanies this podcast. Enjoy. See you next time.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.